KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The annual Portland Fermentation Festival, affectionately known as Stinkfest, is back this year after a three-year hiatus due to the pandemic. The festival returns for the 11th time since it started in 2009, this Thursday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust's Irving Street Studio and Rooftop Terrace in Portland's Pearl District. We hosted the festival organizers Liz Crane, Heidi Nessler, and Claudia Lucero, collectively known as the Stinkfest Queens, for a preview of the 10th annual event in 2019. And we're fortunate to have two of the queens here with us today, Liz and Heidi. Thanks so much for coming into KBOO, bearing samples of some of the treats you'll be featuring at the festival. And Claudia, if you're listening, we miss you.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Ken.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Liz, let's start with you. You were one of the organizers of the very first Portland Fermentation Festival in 2009.
Yeah.
How did it come together? It was a much smaller fermentation community at the time, wasn't it?
It was. A couple friends and I decided that we wanted to have something where we could gather everyone together, a lot of amateur makers, and kind of open up the world of fermentation to Portlanders. And it went really, really well. And Heidi's been a part of it from year one as yeah. well. But we had a line around the block, and kids always have gotten in for free, so kids 12 and younger. Lots of young, hungry to ferment and sample ferment kiddos there. Yeah.
Now, fermentation has been around for thousands of years. Not only has it brought us healthy and tasty things to eat, but it's been essential in preserving foods before the age of refrigerators and freezers. When I posted on social media about the festival, a friend commented, "Isn't the correct term for fermentation when applied to anything but yogurt, beer, wine, and kombucha?" He's got a very narrow view there, called rotting. And I would say the chemical process is similar, but the results are very different.
Right. I think that you do get a lot of like textural changes and flavor changes, even the color of foods change as they ferment. But, you know, I think that most people would attest who've been to the fermentation festival, that process makes things more delicious. And so it's not a yucky rotting thing. Although there are some acquired flavors for a lot of the foods that are fermented. And that
I
folks
know that's
can
true
try.
With some cheeses
yeah.
I've had. But you know, it's a matter of taste.
Exactly.
It won't kill you.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Now, Heidi, this is the first festival since 2019.
Yeah.
You took a break, the festival did, during the pandemic. When did you, Liz and Claudia, make the decision to bring it back this year?
You know, we looked at that each summer, I think we were kind of, or even earlier in the spring, we were checking yeah. in, and does this feel like the right time? And I think it just felt like, you know, it was time to bring it back, and so excited to be back. Oh, my gosh.
Now, there were a few changes for this year's festival. It's basically the same location at Portland's EcoTrust Conference Center, but you have a bigger space, I read, much bigger, actually twice as big as yeah. as 2019.
Yeah, so we'll be on the ground floor, so it's, you know, easier to get in and out, and there's going to be a little more space. If anybody's been to a past festival, it was like we're all tucked in like sardines. So yeah, there'll be a little more space, and we'll still have all the goodies on the rooftop.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah,
yeah, there's quite a bit
so
going on
changed.
The rooftop
yeah.
terrace.
Yeah.
Now, does the extra space open the door for more exhibitors and events this year? I know you've added at least one event. That's the Bacterial Petting Zoo, which I've got to ask you about.
Petting Zoo, yes, indeed. Yeah, and we just have, you know, we really wanted it to feel comfortable for people after COVID. So it's really about having more space and more places to mingle and try the ferments. So, yeah.
I feel like in the past, Ken, like it's always sort of, I call it butt to butt and elbow to elbow at the festival.
It was that dance.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really up close and personal. And while we do want to still foster that hugging and everyone being in the same space and sampling the foods, like we want people to be able to have a little breathing room too.
Yeah. Respectful of yeah. how they're feeling these
exactly.
days.
Exactly.
You know, if they
yeah,
want to
yeah.
be in
the
big
so.
Crowd or kind of off fight by themselves.
Yeah.
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 Now, you're also bringing back two of the most popular attractions, the DIY fermentation station And I love the names, the Starter Barter Culture and Adoption Center, which, I mean, just kind of rolls off the tongue. Can you talk about those and some of the other special events planned?
Yeah, those are both. I'm really excited about them. So People's Co-op always sort of sponsors our event in terms of giving us produce for that fermentation station. And in the past, we've had, you know, you can get up to the table and make your own sauerkraut to take home and then ferment at home. And this year we're having dilly beans. So they've donated a bunch of green beans and we'll have them, you know, trimmed and rinsed. And then like kids and adults can kind of saddle up and get their jar and put the spices in and then take home something to, you know, ferment on the countertop for the next several days or possibly a couple weeks, depends on how funky you want those beans to be. But also, yeah, the Starter Barter and Adoption Center, that one's really fun. I kind of stink right now, like vinegar, because I was putting together all of my vinegar mothers and kombucha mothers for people to take home. So it's right, you bring whatever you have. You have a sourdough bread culture, you have water kefir crystals, you have whatever these cultures are that make these delicious foods. Then you can bring extras because they do reproduce. You can bring extras and then people can take what they want home and hopefully they're empowered to then, you know, make that ferment at home.
So it's a great way to get started with fermenting your own foods.
Yeah, exactly. And I think of all the folks that took up sourdough baking during the pandemic, if they have an abundant amount of sourdough starter, this is the place. Just label it also in the little Ziploc bag we know what to do with it.
Now, Liz, you always have special guests at the festival, all luminaries in the world of fermented food. Remember 2019, you hosted David Zilber, who's in charge of fermentation at Noma in Copenhagen, which was named the best restaurant in the world four times, I think.
Yeah.
maybe again since 2019. You know, I didn't check.
Oh, and well, they close the doors. So now, but they are doing a lot of research and development and products and all kinds of really
restaurants.
Exactly.
Wow, I didn't know about that.
But anyhow, yeah, he was a wonderful. His talk was so great and inspiring. And I think you were leading to Kirsten Schocke.
I was going to say, true to form, this year's guest is another star in the fermentation world, at Kirsten, who actually doesn't have to come all the way from Denmark. She lives in Southern Oregon.
Southern Oregon, yes. That's correct.
Yeah, we're really excited for her to come up. And what we do with all of our, you know, honorary guest speakers like Sandor Katz and David Zilber and Kirsten is just sort of say, we roll out the sparkly green carpet and just say, talk about whatever you want, whatever you're excited about, because that will, you know, excite all of the attendees. So I know a little tiny bit of what she's planning to talk about.
Can you tell us, or is that kind of giving away too much?
Yeah, on her social media, she posted a ferment, an achar, like a South Asian kind of mustardy, pickly thing that she was fermenting and was going to talk about. So I think that's just one of many things that she'll have as topics.
And she'll be giving the keynote at 6 o'clock.
Exactly.
And that will be followed by a Q&A session.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. 6 to 7 is all Kirsten Schocke and her wisdom and all of that. And then after that, we have all sorts of things planned that we've mentioned. There's a really fun Japanese participatory like fermentation dance that's going to happen, like a Hakka Bon Adori dance, and that will happen after Kirsten's talk.
Will that be on the rooftop terrace?
That will most likely, it's going to start on the first floor, and then it, you know, dependent on how many people participate and like how exciting it is for people, it might move out to the lobby, it might move up to the rooftop. We're kind of go with the flow, with the fermentation fever.
Yes. theme of fermentation. Go with the flow.
Another good idea to have all that extra room this year, too, for the dancing.
Yeah.
Now, Liz, you've authored several food books yourself, including Dumplings Equal Love, which you've talked about, Hello, My Name is Tasty, the Toro Bravo Cookbook. And you've been involved with the Fermentation Festival, you know, we said, since 2009, so 15 years now. But you only recently published your first book on fermentation called Fermenter DIY Fermentation for Vegan Fare, which came out just last month. What took you so long?
Well, I don't know. That's a really good question. I feel like a lot of the books that I've worked on, though, have had ferments in them. But yeah, I just really wanted to focus on a 100% fermentation cookbook. And so Aaron Adams was also hoping to do a book.
What
and
a
so
good we partnered co-author. Up.
Yeah. So really just kind of thank my lucky stars how that all kind of aligned. But it's also, he will be there at the festival as one of the exhibitors, and I'm not sure what he's preparing food or drink wise to sample, but he'll be there for the book, and that's going to be fun.
And Aaron is the owner and the chef at Portland's Fermenter restaurant, right. Which is a vegan fermented food.
Yeah, and I do feel like a lot of, like, at our festival, of course, ferments can be, you know, dairy, meat, seafood, but a lot of the ferments at our festival over the years have tended to be plant-based. So there are some outliers, but that's a way of saying, like, for it's very vegan friendly, I think, that plant-based
and folks. The perfect city for it. I know when I told some people about the interview we did on the cookbook, they were just excited because it was tasty vegan food, which vegans are always looking for.
Right.
Their choices are a little bit more limited than people who aren't vegan.
One of the yummy things that will be at the festival is wampaku natto. We didn't talk about that.
I was going to talk about
that. Sorry, I got ahead of you.
that's Heidi's business, wampako natto. And that is a fermented soybean, which you discovered when you were living in Japan, Heidi.
That's right. Yeah, I really, it's a traditional Japanese ferment, and it's naturally sticky and from the fermentation. And so for many, they'll characterize it as an acquired taste, but I really loved it the first time I tried it. And that's actually been my experience when I've sampled it with folks.
And it's like, very popular. It's a breakfast food in Japan,
you
mostly?
Know, it's, or? Yeah, it's traditionally eaten at breakfast, but really, you can have it any time of the day. Yeah. Yeah, I gave you some, so you can give it a shot.
And of course, the attendees can try the natto too
at the festival. Yes, absolutely. And we also really encourage exhibitors to bring some novel ferments. You know, things that if they have a company, they don't always do. So I'll be bringing a navy bean ferment that I'm preparing, like baked beans on toast.
Wow! So, is that from Japan too, or is that something you came up with?
That's what I came up with.
Wow! Innovative.
Yeah. So it's a special just for the Fermentation Fest.
Oh, that's exciting.
And of course, there'll be there'll be fermented food from all different cultures all over the world.
Yeah.
I know a lot of us associate fermented foods with Asia, and I think Aaron mentions that in the cookbook, but we also mention cultures like Scandinavia. I know my Eastern European roots, pickled herring, kosher pickles, things like that. There's so many fermented foods from all over the world.
Yeah, I'm really excited this year. We have misos, we have tempeh. We also have Eleni's Kitchen bringing injera, the traditional soured bread, in Ethiopian cuisine.
Oh, Ethiopian, yes. You go to an Ethiopian restaurant and it's almost like a pizza.
Yes,
they have the
big
injera bread and then everything is on there.
Yeah.
And you don't get utensils, you eat it with the bread.
Right, exactly. So she'll be demoing that with some of her simmer sauces.
So Africa we're adding to Asia and, of course, Europe and all over the world.
And Old Portland, right? That Depression era, those pickles.
We have an amateur fermenter bringing pickles, and maybe you know about these. They were very popular.
Kosher pickles?
They were sold at Meyer and Frank and Mrs. I don't know how to say her name properly, but Neuschen or Mrs. Neuschen.
I've heard of that, yes.
Yes, there's a whole cult around bringing these pickles back. And this gentleman approached me saying he had, you know, really gotten this together and wanted to exhibit them. So he'll be there too.
Oh, that's exciting because it's hard to get a really good kosher pickle in Portland.
Yeah.
It's not a big deli city usually. Now, Liz, while food and drink will be available for sale on the rooftop terrace, the rest of the festival is non-transactional.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what that means and why you chose that model, which is not typical for most food events?
Yeah, we really just want everyone to interact and skill share and talk to one another. And so we think that, like, getting in line to buy things sort of gets in the way of that. So our festival ethic has always been, you purchase your ticket. You can purchase them at portlandfermentationfestival.com. We still have tickets. And then once you get into the festival, though, There's nothing to be bought.
That's
nothing
a good
to
feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Except on the rooftop, you can get, you know, like you can get your Indian meal from Desi PDX and cider from Swift Cider. But on the ground level, yeah, it's just bartering, sharing, sampling, talking to each other.
Now, Liz and Heidi, you must be extremely busy with the festival coming up in 2 days. I want to thank you so much for taking time out to join us at KBOO.
Thank you so much, Kim. It's always fun to talk to you.
We've been talking with Liz Crane and Heidi Nessler, two of the organizers of the 11th Annual Portland Fermentation Festival, which takes place this Thursday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust Irving Street Studio and Rooftop Terrace, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. You can learn more and purchase tickets in advance on their website, portlandfermentationfestival.com, and on the festival's Facebook page. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
I'm Michelle Coppola. It appears that right-wing Russians would like to push Cuba in a neoliberal direction. Early this year, Russia and Cuba signed an agreement promising to significantly increase Russian participation in the Cuban economy. The move comes over 30 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the close association that Moscow had with Havana. But why is this happening now? To find out, KBOO's David Rosenberg spoke with retired Brooklyn College professor Samuel Farber, who wrote about the new Russian presence in Cuba for Foreign Policy in Focus. He began by asking Farber if the Russian presence was really all that new.
I think it's totally new in the sense that this new, let's call it offensive, on the part of Russia began at the beginning of this year. And I think most likely is because given the conflict of their invasion of Ukraine, they're trying to look for support wherever they can. Now, as I try to argue or show in my article, what they're doing is that they're promising the moon in general terms, but in actual delivery of things, what they have committed themselves to deliver in Cuba is pretty small stuff. You know, fixing one sugar mill here, finishing a factory over there and a few odds and ends that do not really amount to much. While on the level of rhetoric, they're talking about really transforming the Cuban economy and, in this particular case, trying to push very much for privatization because the people at the head that Putin sent to Cuba are really the right wing of his support in the sense that they represent organizations that are very much identified with the business sector in Russia.
So the Cuban government, you know, they've made statements of socialism forever, and they want to maintain some sort of at least facade that they are opposing the capitalist world. Do you think they would be willing to make such a deal if it involved a good deal of privatization?
I think that some people in the Cuban government are more willing than others, but given the seriousness of the crisis, that puts tremendous pressure on all of them to try to get some concessions from Russia to significantly improve the situation, something that I am very skeptical that Russia is willing to go that far. To go as far as necessary to make a difference in terms of the situation of the Cuban economy. So I think that the Cuban government has just approved 1 to 2 years ago the opening, legal opening of what they call NIPIMES in Cuba, which is an acronym signifying a micro, small, and medium-sized enterprise, private enterprise, that in the case of the medium one, the medium size can be as many as 100 workers, which is a lot. That is really a capitalist enterprise, but you know, it's not a self-administered little business. So they have given concessions because their backs have been against the wall. I mean, the Cuban government. How far they're willing to go, that is something that you can put a question mark, and that is subject, of course, to the pressures that they will continue to experience. The Cuban government, Cuba and the Cuban government, are going now through a crisis that is only second, so far, second to the collapse, the one that took place after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s. But with features of it, which didn't happen at that time. One feature, for example, is the absolutely incredible massive exodus. We're witnessing the largest immigration wave that Cuba, whether revolutionary or pre-revolution, has ever witnessed. And this is clearly...
Even more than the mid-60s when they...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is calculated that by the end of this year, 450,000 Cubans of a population of 11 million will have left Cuba. And clearly, it has the approval of the government because of the following reason. The way in which a great majority of Cubans emigrate now is through Nicaragua, because Nicaragua, as of the end of 2021, does not require visas for Cubans. So that means, Cuba is an island. So it's not like Venezuela, that people literally walk across the border to Colombia. It's a very different situation. And I mentioned Venezuela because they too have had a massive immigration, even bigger, but again, has land borders with other countries. Cuba does not. So for Nicaragua to have approved such a change, obviously at the very minimum, is because it counts with the approval of Cuba, which is an ally of theirs, and more likely it was requested by Cuba. We don't know, of course. So it's a massive immigration. And of course, I haven't seen anything, nor anybody else has, of the age and racial breakdown. But usually the people who emigrate are the younger people when immigration is open, completely like as it is now. And that will have a worsening effect on the demographic crisis that Cuba has had now, I would say, starting as early, in a gradual fashion, starting as early as the early 80s, but accelerated with the passage of time. And this will only worsen that situation because the younger people, who have children, are the ones who will have left. So it's a fairly serious crisis, big inflation. And again, the concessions that the government is willing to make will depend very much on how long and how severe this crisis is.
So in the Soviet period, the Soviet Union would buy Cuban sugar.
Right.
And right. They're not offering any kind of deal like that. Is that because they're not capable of it?
Well, you know, it's a different system. You know, as I also pointed out in my article, in the Soviet Union, it was two bureaucratic states dealing with each other. And in the part of the Soviet Union, their willingness for political reasons, to give concessions that the market, quote unquote, the market economy would not give. The situation now is different. The situation is that this is kind of a, how to call Russia, it's a racketeering capitalist country. You know, that's the only word that comes to mind. And the Russian capitalists are several hundred of them who are immensely wealthy. Their wealth goes back to the 90s when they literally stole public property and appropriated with the agreement of first Yeltsin and then eventually Putin, because this process started with Yeltsin. No, it's not just Putin, but it got much more advanced. And of course, Putin has been in power a much longer time. So the government is very involved with the so-called private enterprise, but it's not a situation the Soviet Union, for geopolitical reasons, could give a lot of concessions to Cuba to maintain that knife in the back of the U.S., as Washington would see it. That is no longer really on the table.
There has been some pressure from American business interests to allow more of an opening to Cuba to get in there and do investments. Do you see the United States under that kind of pressure and seeing that the Russians are in there wanting to change the relationship with Cuba?
Well, I think that what some people on the left in the United States, the left I'm also part of, have realized is that the American ruling class are not at all concerned with Cuba. And in fact, for quite some time, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is a very conservative right-wing organization, has been for a long time in favor of economic relations with Cuba. And in fact, the agribusiness interests in the United States are very much, very strongly in favor of relations with Cuba, because Cuba, even under current circumstances, is a big importer of agricultural goods. Practically every chicken consumed in Cuba comes from the U.S. As you know, those come out from Arkansas and places like that, which are hardly liberal progressive places, to put it mildly. So in some of the most conservative states of the Union, there are business lobbies that are very much in favor of trade with Cuba, especially agribusiness.
What do you see happening in the near future? Do you think that Cuba will get closer to the Russians?
Well, to the extent that Russia delivers in some of its grandiose promises, which I'm very skeptical about, in that sense, they may be able to achieve, get some kind of clout there. But I suspect, I have no way of proving this, of course, but I suspect that the Russian promises to Cuba are very much tied to the situation in Ukraine. And the moment that the war comes to an end, whether through a Korea-type armistice, where, as you know, to this day, peace has not been signed between North Korea and the U.S. I mean, that was, what, 60 years ago or more. But there is an armistice. So that's one of the possible conclusions of this process. At that point, I think Russia possibly may lose interest in Cuba. But what I forgot to say earlier, I'm sorry if I bring this up now, is that the biggest obstacle to a resumption of U.S.-Cuba relations is the political situation in Florida, where what had been previously in the, this interesting change in the 2012 and 2016 presidential elections, the Cuban-American vote for Obama and then for Hillary had gone up considerably and was close to 50-50. I think it was like 55-45 in favor of the Republicans at the presidential level. Under Trump, that changed completely. For a combination of reasons, the Democrats are in a very bad situation in the state of Florida, and that was reflected in their inability or unwillingness or apathy, whatever it might be, to organize among Cubans. And Trump came into South Florida with a very considerable effort to recruit not only Cubans, but people from Venezuela, people who came from quote-unquote communist countries, and he succeeded in doing that with the help of influencers like an infamous guy, his last name is Otaola, and they turned around the situation back to the way it had been 15 years ago.
Because there was a split, right? There were more and more Cubans that wanted an opening to Cuba.
Right. So the situation now is much less favorable in Florida. So I think that what happens in Florida, which is still, well, it's no longer an even divided state. The Republicans swept. I mean, even in Dade County, which is the county in which Miami is situated, that had been a Democratic stronghold for decades. And DeSantis obtained a huge majority in Dade County in the last time he ran for governor. So I'm sorry if I went back to that, but
Speaking of jumping around, I was going to ask you about Cuba using tourism to boost its economy. And it seems like it had some success with that, but you would say it's just not enough?
Yes, I think that if you look back to 2018, that was a very high point in tourism. I think it was well over 4 million a year. It didn't reach 5 million, but it was like 4.4 or 4.5, something like that. Very, very large tourist rate. Then in 2019, it began to go down because Trump made it more difficult for Cubans in the United States to travel to Cuba. And certainly for people, to make it more difficult for Americans who were not Cubans to travel to Cuba, because a lot of Americans had gone en masse in 2017, 2018. So that diminished. But what really hit tourism very badly in Cuba was the COVID pandemic, because tourism just practically collapsed as it did in many other places throughout the world. However, if you look, for example, the Dominican Republic, that is a much larger tourist power, if you want to use that term, than Cuba ever was.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.